Good evening and welcome to a fireside chat. I'm sorry that I was a little bit late tonight, but I had to throw an extra log in the fire. It was burning a little bit low, and I wanted it to be really cozy for my guest tonight. This is your host, Lance White, otherwise known as the Zany Mystic. Tonight's guest is an author who has written a book called When the Angels Have Risen. However, the book is not about angelic visitations necessarily. It's a scathing satire of a time reminiscent of today, of course, loosely written about today, where Halliburton is president and the main character is abducted by benevolent ETs. Let's find out more from the mind of its author, Andrew Fader. Welcome, Andrew. How are you?
Doing pretty good. Thank you for having me on your...
Oh, you're very welcome. Did I say your name right?
Yeah, it's Fader. That's fine.
Fader, okay.
Can you hold on one second?
Are you there?
Okay, sorry.
Okay.
Okay, hello?
Yes, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, good. For those who haven't read the book yet, would you give us a little background on the plot so that our listeners have an idea of what the story's about?
Yeah, well, the main character, Jerry Fletcher, we find him coming from Los Angeles. He's an average man who, through his midlife crisis, whatever, had very heavy struggles during his time in L.A. and wanted to try a whole new life.
Uh-huh.
Comes to Las Vegas, and for the first time, he is inducted into the 9-to-5 thing, because prior, he was basically self-employed most of his life. He gets enhanced into it, and does his thing, and eventually, we find him go on a hiking trip with some of his coworkers, and he sort of breaks away. This is in the area of Las Vegas, and he breaks away from his friends, and somehow he's like compelled, almost like being magnet, like being pulled to a secluded spot within this canyon area, whereby he is, and I don't like to use the word abducted, because that sounds sort of like negative, like he's kidnapped, but he was like transported on to an alien ship. At first, while he's on the ship, he's thinking it's like a dream, it's surreal, who would know? And when he comes to the realization what's really around him, he meets one of the figures on the ship who shows him that they've been around.
Uh-huh.
In fact, many types of aliens have been around for thousands upon thousands of years on Earth. And in doing so, he also shows him how they've been involved with a lot of the involvement of humanity, in particular with their spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
He shows them, for example, during the biblical events and how with Jesus and with Moses, and he goes on and on, and he shows them how they're all involved, but there has always been two factions basically fighting on a spiritual side within what's happening on the Earth planet.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically coming back telling that how they're trying to take full force. Eventually, Jerry is sent back, a whole new man, with all this knowledge and grade embedded in him.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes down, the government tries to get hold, as he reappears, tries to get a hold of him and sort of sequester him to keep him out from people knowing who he is. And he's like picked up by a reporter who gets him out of the grasp of the government's hold and gets him out, and he speaks in a public arena within one of the campuses here in Las Vegas, and it's broadcast, riots break out. Eventually, this evolves into a civil war, and you'll know by who the people who I speak with within the book, the commonalities, President Halliburton, who that's implying. It shows the cultural wars that are happening, all the situations that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be able to relate to what is almost as now. I actually wrote this back in 2000. What I, put together what was sort of like the realm of what's happening within our own country as well as around the world.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, like I said, turmoil turns into chaos, but chaos becomes. People start rising up and standing up for themselves, and that's and of course there's a surprise at the end of the book.
Yeah.
And
that was fun. I like that. And I'm pretty irreverent myself and rebellious, and I love the you throwing Halliburton in there as president. I really laughed about that one. And I also like the rebellious nature of it, and you know, the idea of people rising up and taking control of their lives. I'm going to have to ask you where you got the inspiration ideas and ideas for the story, because it sounds as if, I mean, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but it sounds as if you might have had an experience with a ship yourself.
I wouldn't say, first of all, regarding how I felt on the spirit, first I believe that there's obviously ETs and,
right, right.
And there's a connection. I've had where certain incidents have happened where, in one particular where, and I don't know if I was, you know, I lost a time element where, in fact, I was with a close friend of mine who I had, we were coming to Vegas, and this was way back in the mid-90s. And people, I don't know if they're familiar with the area, but if you're heading from L.A. to, you go to, you know, to like Baker, and there's Barstow and Bish, and we got to Baker. First of all, we left from Los Angeles about 7 o'clock. We arrived in Baker approximately at 10 o'clock. When we left from Baker, we were heading toward Vegas. All of a sudden, little weird lights and things were happening. We didn't take notice of it because we just thought, you know, it's because it's totally black and just stars. And, you know, you can see, we're, you know, pretty well the Milky Way from then on until you get to start hitting close to Vegas. And all of a sudden, you know, I started nodding off. Blah, 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 and, you know, you feel sort of tired. Mm-hmm. And next thing I know, I see the sunrise. And I go, wait a second here. I go, Ellie, what's this going on here? And he just realized it. And I go, it's 6 o'clock. you know, it's only half an hour away, you know, at the most an hour, 45 minutes to Vegas from Baker. And so, you know, that was the only weirdest thing. There was a tape that was shown to me a long time ago, back in the mid-90s, about, and it was about a man who was from Germany who was actually abducted in the U.K., and they had verified, I can't remember his name though, they had verified that, you know, he was, they took him, you know, whether, you know, you put him on a lie detector and all the series of events to show if he was really fabricating this story, but turned out, you know, he was telling the truth. And as he was telling what was happening on this thing, it gave me more of a connection, because he was talking in a funny verbiage, and I asked a friend of mine, I said, slow down, let me listen to it again. And he was speaking in Hebrew, what the aliens were saying.
Wow.
And it sort of connected, well, wait a second, because I know, look in the Bible, like Ezekiel 1, and all that, whether it's Elijah being picked up, and I always felt there was always definitely a connection with, you know, the biblical events happening with aliens. I also felt like connection with whether it would be the Egyptians and as far as also in Asia country, you know, in Asia as far as Buddha. I mean, I felt too many connections. And then if people read Chariots of the Gods, there's an obvious thing. I read that back when I was a kid in college back in the 70s. So I definitely had a premonition of that connection, and I just felt there was more, not just the artifact part of it, that there was definitely a spiritual side of it.
You know, the plot that you were just speaking about, and I've read the book, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. I had some fun with it, especially towards the end. It had some fun twists and turns, but it's very, very similar, the idea of, you know, various alien or extraterrestrial factions, you know, vying for control over the planet, is very reminiscent of a channeling that Barbara Marciniak did in, I guess, the 80s from the Pleiadians. And that was the first time I'd ever read anything about, you know, the possibility that there was something like that even possible. But it resonated for me, and I've seen that idea recurring over and over and over, that indeed there may be some kind of advanced beings, and they're not all benevolent. I wanted to ask you about that part of it. Were you familiar with any of the Pleiadian stuff, or was that just intuitive that it came to you?
It just basically intuitively. Most of the stuff on a spiritual basis, I put a lot of that, all of my whole book together, basically feeling what was, I felt was, you know, what is happening now and what has happened, and I had an inclination of what would be happening in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my book was basically to bring out a message, basically to allow people to develop their self-worthiness,
mm-hmm.
to therefore believe in themselves and not just, you know, question the clerics, question authority, and look
mm-hmm.
beyond what is actually being shown to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the part of the alien thing, connection or ETs or whatever, to put what is the reality, because
mm-hmm.
we constantly try to separate ourselves, whether it's black, white,
mm-hmm.
you know, liberal,
mm-hmm.
you know, right wing,
mm-hmm.
Christian, Muslim, Jew, Buddhist. You know, we're constantly trying to separate ourselves, and I was trying to show here we're just human,
mm-hmm.
And I try showing a commonality. That's why also within my book I do some quotings from the Bible, but also still quotings from the Tao Te Ching. And I was trying to show that there is an actual, if you take Taoism and Judaism and, you know, and Native Americanism or beliefs in spirituality and also within agnostic Christianity as opposed to the Orthodox Christianity. I mean, I'm talking about original Christianity, probably what the, you know, the original Christians were.
But yeah.
And also the Muslims, in the fundamentals, they're basically all dealing, utilizing the same spiritual tone and as a love and God and all that, but their mechanics are slightly different, but they're all achieving the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my main thing, that it was basically everybody's doing this different things.
Mm-hmm.
We're all reaching a commonality. The problem is that people tend to use spirituality, and this has been going on for thousands of years. And that includes the Jerry Farwells of today and the Pat Robbins of today. The same thing happened in the past. I mean, you look what's going on around the world with the Muslims and even extremisms and Jews and
mm-hmm.
and Christians, and they're utilizing the fundamentals of religion and twisting and turning things to manipulate their own, you know, masses to basically for control and power and money.
It sure seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's not a new game, it's an old game.
Yeah, it seems like it's been played over and over and over, and it's about time for it to end, I think.
Yeah, and it's enough. I mean, you see what's going on in Iraq. I mean, I'm laughing because before he came on, I was watching Keith Olbermann joking about Stay the Course.
Oh, brother.
Yeah, and it's like even politics of the day. You look in Iraq, I mean, people are killing, the Iraqis are killing because of two types of Muslims, Shiites and Sunnis. I mean, I lived in Israel for during the 80s for 6 years, during the time of the Lebanese situation, and here I'm sitting on not far within Lebanon situation and watching rockets flying from, you know, the Christian village into a Shiite Muslim village. You know, it was like a joke. I mean, it was like everybody's killing each other over what? My God better than your God?
Yeah.
And it's like pathetic. I mean, come on, you know.
Yeah.
Is that what religion is, to kill each other? Or is it to, you know, learning to love God and loving your fellow man and loving humanity? You know, so it's to me, it's sort of an oxymoron.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. More of the moron than anything else.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you mentioned living in Israel. You know, we don't really have, at least I don't have, a very clear idea of what the people or the country is like over there. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Israeli people? Because I really don't know much about them. They seem like, you know, I hesitate to make any assessment because I don't know. I imagine they have the same desires interests and fears that we all have, but what's your feeling about the Israeli people and what's going on over there?
My feeling is there's twofold. First, Israeli people, they're very tough,
mm-hmm.
And they're basically survivors. They're survivors, and people when you. What you see on the news is not at all what's really going on over there. I mean, I was there, I remember, during the 80s, and what they show on the news is totally different even what was going on in Lebanon.
Really?
There's a lot of fabrication. As far as during the warring events, I mean, there's a lot of staging by, and I hate to put it, be sound one-sided, but there's a lot of staging that goes on as far as things. And, you know, the Israelis are like the one of the worst as far as public relations that goes. And they're people have to realize they feel like, looking at where they came, most of the people have come, and it's, you know, only so many generations since the Holocaust. You have so many Jews who came from the Arab countries who have been, you know, attacked and slaughtered and whatever, and still they feel like this is their last hold.
Yeah.
And so when they're getting attacked, they naturally, you know, backlash. Overall, though, Israelis are trying to figure a way of somehow creating a peace, you know, somehow of peace. I mean, they're constantly trying to reach out. I'm talking to most Israelis, 80-90% of Israelis. You'll have, you know, just like a lot of countries, you'll have a small extremists who are religious. We have to, you know, no way, we won't go any, no, you know, we won't want to deal with like the Arabs or Muslims or whatever. And you know, it's either our way or the highway, and they have no way of compromising. But that is not the trend. I mean, basically, Israelis are more open to try to make a change. I when I lived there, it was a little different, too, because when I was living there, the Arabs that were living in the West Bank, the Palestinians at the time, there was no real problems at the time. And at that time, people didn't realize they were also Jordanian citizens. And when the whole thing, everything started, and there's a vacuum, people leave it out. But it's when Jordan made peace with Israel, they removed their claim to the West Bank with Israelis, and then they immediately removed the citizenship of everybody in there. So there was a vacuum, and that's where a lot of the politics happen, and you know, go on and on. But that's, you know, my view is I feel like really Jordan's part of the Palestinian mandate. Jordan and Israel should just make a joint control and you know, whoever lives there, take your choice, and then you're finished, you know. And same thing with Gaza.
I think both of us realize that there are people pulling strings behind the scenes that, you know, have their own agenda way beyond anything that any particular country or government would like.
Yeah. There's a conflict. The thing that people don't realize is that conflict between Jews and Muslims was not between them. It was actually inspired by the British way, you know, in the very beginning. And it's, and I feel that's what I still feel a lot. Part of the even the conflict was, you know, escalated even when the Soviets decided to be on the side of the Arabs, and then the Americans decided to be on the side of the Israelis. And that happened from the 50s through the 60s. But then in 48, it was actually the Soviets who were backed Israel because the British had backed the Arabs. So it seems like the conflict is always outside influences trying to push their buttons on everybody within there. And there, it seems like and that was also pointed within my book, there's a part of it I talk about that area, if they were united, would probably be probably stronger than the Europeans, just for the people realize not, the Israelis and the Jews and the Arabs, when they are so passionately intelligent, it's amazing. And if they took their passion instead of an aggression, but and used it in a positive form, it would be, you know, I mean, look at all the ideas that came out within that area.
Well, that's the same principle that would apply to all of us, too, that, you know, if we turned away, you know, if we finally make the shift from an old paradigm of having to kill each other, you know, for some bizarre reason, to one of supporting and helping each other because we actually are each other, you know, and we're united in spirit, then it seems that the world would be a different place. And, you know, it just shocks me that people in America are so quick to say, oh, just nuke them. You know, I mean, that seems to be the solution for a lot of people that, you know, stay at home and watch Fox News and so on and so forth. And, oh, let's just bomb them right now, you know, press the red button. You know, but that is not a solution.
I tend to see if anybody has, and you ask any person who's been in war, they will tell you they don't want to see another war.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the most vile thing you can ever see. It's not people are too used to watching it on TV or or you know, like I think it's a video game. These are real life. Just imagine your family's getting blown apart and your buildings and things happening, and you're walking down the street and suddenly your bus blows up, or you know, Katusha flies in your way, or you know, or a bomb hits another place, and or then all of a sudden you're being attacked. You know, like what happened within Iraq. I mean. It's, or even Lebanon, I mean, it's that. That's like the worst, that's when man becomes his lowest denominator.
Well, you know, I have to agree with you on that one, and I'm all for, you know, calling a halt to this and, you know, pulling the people out, you know. But we'll have to see what happens in the near future, because obviously somebody on the top wants to stay the course, and he's not talking about a golf course.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about how your life might have changed since you wrote the book.
Well, since I wrote the book, because I wrote it back in 2000, I've been actually more passionate as toward as far as my politics. I originally had the idea, and when I formulated it and it was compelled to write the book, it was actually right after Bush became president, and I was so upset the way he became president. I mean, I wouldn't have been upset if he was actually elected president. But being appointed in the Supreme Court put a stop from people's having the right to vote and having it counted. That sort of irked me, being an American, because I think fundamentally being American is having your, and being in a democracy is your right to vote. And that really bugged me. If, and even if somebody, there's dumb enough, I hate to put it that way, to vote for him, and they did do it, and there's more than a vote, you know, oh, well, I you know, I live with it. But when it's a situation where our own democracy has was undermined, that really bothered me. And then people just moves along like, you know, sheep and cattle. Like
I know. Doesn't it seem like no matter what?
Even the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party bothered me. They just sat back and says, oh, well, what are we going to do? And they actually could have done something.
Well, you know, you have to wonder if it isn't a whole bad bushel of apples. You know, I mean, I really don't think that, you know, there's even a good apple in there left. So, you know, as far as there being an actual choice on size, I'm not so certain that either side is better or worse. They're just, you know, two aspects of the same coin, you know. And, you know, it's just shocking how many rights have been eroded. And we each time something comes up, it's like, well, that's okay. We can live with that. Microchip? Oh, sure, we can be microchipped. Or,
but this is going way back, Lance. You know what? When I lived in Israel, I used to, on my farm. I came to Israel when Reagan became president. Okay. And every year in the winter season, I used to go back to the U.S. Hang out with my dad, help him in his business. He had a construction company, and every year I noticed our rights being diminished, and it was sort of opposite in Europe. See, in Europe and in Israel, it was very socialized. They're very, couldn't say a lot of things you could say. I mean, even in Israel, it was socialized. You couldn't, you had freedoms, but it was their law was like British law.
Okay.
And then it was weird. Slowly after, because when I was there, Begin had just became the prime minister for a couple of years. And it was changing. It was becoming, you're having more rights. And then in Europe, the same thing. And then Britain was changing because I don't know if you remember the thing. In fact, they made a movie. They had a law where they could just throw you away and lock the key. And there was, I think, the movie called All About the Father. I forget. It was a famous about they suspected IRA family, and they were never had nothing to do with IRA at all. And they yanked them all out, threw them in jail, and threw the key away. And it was all fabrication. They didn't have any rights. You couldn't say a lot of stuff. And then it slowly changed. And then while I was coming here, it was going opposite. You're losing rights. It seemed like it was going back. And then culturally it was changing. Because when I left the U.S., people were, I guess it was still the Carter thing. It was the 70s. People were more humanitarian, more caring about the others. They're more... And then as I was coming back, it seemed they were revolving from the hippie side of things, I guess you'd call it, being more, you know, concerned, became more of the yuppies, of more narcissism, and threw away the bees to get the BMW, you know, and it became everything about yourself and became more selfish. And as they became more selfish, they didn't really care.
Yep.
And as they didn't care, they were really for just to have something more. They were sold a bag of goods. Here, get this, get the material thing, but we're going to take your rights at the same time.
And exactly.
Basically, this is not overnight. I mean, it happened for 20 years.
Well, maybe that's why people aren't more upset and shocked, because it has been such a gradual change, you know, that it's really almost kind of sneaky. You'd almost think it was kind of planned out.
Well, look at the media consolidation. There's if you look at news, I mean, what Bush has broken, like, some over 300 laws, I think, the American Bar Association. If this happened back in the 70s, you'd have every week from the, you know, L.A. Times, the Washington Post, and every paper would be going after him. And what did they do? They sat back. They didn't do anything. Why? Oh, because they're basically one media right now. You know, how many medias? There's News Corp, there's the Tribune, which was L.A. Times and the Tribune. And
it's basically all the same company, isn't it?
Yeah, they're basically consolidated.
There's no clean news in there. It's all pretty much mandated, and nothing that's controversial or negative ever gets through. You know, you have to really dig around on the Internet to find out what's going on in the world.
Exactly. And a good example of how there's such a control of the media, Ella, the good example of the media is what happened with the Dixie Chicks, where they voiced their opinion, how they felt about, you know, but next thing you know, they were blackmailed, almost like, you know, the Americans back in the actors who got blackmailed back in the 50s.
It was like when they went to the communists.
The MacArthur hearing.
MacArthur era, that was it,
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, it's pretty scathing, and it seems like it's cycling around again. You know, whatever this cycle is that we're in, it does seem to be, you know, Hitler was, I hate to bring up that word, but, you know, that was one cycle of you know, dictatorship that we went through, and then there have been others, and now we're approaching yet another zenith of this, and it seems like it's just the year for dictators.
Yeah, and there's another extremism that's happening on both sides, and I mean, I've had arguments with, because I feel myself a progressive, but I think a lot of people on the progressive side have become a blind side. I mean, they use the word of Islamic fascism really is there. I mean, there's two sides. There's a Christian fascism and a Islamic fascism on the other side, and everybody else in between. And I think that's where what's going on, what's heading into that course. And I'll give you a bunch of examples. I mean, first of all, everybody knows what's happening with Iran. You go around across the countries where the Muslims have attacked anybody who, you know, I'm talking about extremists, but there's a fundamental purge of extremists already overlaid amongst its populace, almost like in Germany. We have the same thing, but it hasn't gotten to that yet, but we're like heading to that. We were heading there, or hopefully it's stopping, where I believe the right-wing Christian community was pushing within its own agenda, heading into the same thing, and eventually did with the war in Iraq. Besides, I just read in the paper today, I was sort of blown away, Nicaragua is about to outlaw abortion completely.
Oh, really?
And I was reading about what's his name? Ortega. What's his name? Who was head of the Sandinistas, who was socialist, who was, you know, a proponent of being popular amongst its people, who now is a devout Catholic, has turned the country into a neo-Catholic country.
Oh dear.
And there you go. I'm going, oh my God! And there's another extremism of religion taking over.
Yeah.
And I feel that's basically what's going on. And part of my book is to show that people stand up, because if people had self-worth and would stand up to both clerics and to their government, I'm not insinuating, you know, any type of violence,
but I'm saying
standing up. If thousands of people said, hell no, we're not going to take it no more, were they going to arrest 5 million people?
Well,
they couldn't do anything.
You know,
and then even with its own powers, even within its own police, people would say, you know.
I'm not so sure about that. You know, there was just that law put into effect a few days ago that now you can, if they can consider somebody within the country and inside of America as a terrorist if there's some kind of connection or suspected connection. So, you know, and there are lots of camps. The Halliburton has even been responsible for, and you probably know about this, that they built detention camps in America. And they're also building them around the world. Now, who are the ones in America? What's the purpose of new detention camps? Who's going to be staying there? You know, we're not talking about summer camp. We're talking about, you know.
Yeah, that sounds like V Vendetta.
Yeah, wasn't that a great movie?
Yeah.
I really loved that. Jeez, the Wachowski brothers, they, you know, for those who don't know, they did the Matrix trilogy. And V for Vendetta was their latest movie, and I'm telling you, it's chilling, and it's a wonderful movie. What did you think about it?
It was like the same thing, but
yeah.
It was like I felt like that where we could be heading to too, and what you're talking about, the concentration camp.
Yeah, yeah.
But I still feel that if there was enough change and a lot of push.
Mm-hmm.
Even so, people, they could not really, it would be too powerful because I feel like it would, we're not over at that realm. I feel like even, you know, I'll give you an example. I think like, you know, talk about, I feel there would be, there is a democratic, in almost, it could be an explosion within Iran, ironically, mm-hmm. with its own people and its, of all countries that would want to could be turned into a democracy, it was Iran, not Iraq,
mm-hmm.
Because the people had a democracy
mm-hmm.
back in the 50s. And
mm-hmm.
the people there, I mean, you can go on the blogs and somehow they get on there and you can hear what the Iranians are saying,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can see what people from within their own country, they don't want to, they know that they don't like what's going on with how their country is run by clerics.
Mm-hmm.
And they're an example of exactly what we don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's
mm-hmm.
a, you know, if anybody want to, here's your choice. You can be a country that's pretty liberal or having your, like, let's say a Sweden,
mm-hmm.
or do you want to be Iran? There's your choice. There's no real gray.
Yeah.
It's black and white. You're going to either head one way or you're going to end up another way.
Well, I can see where they're pushing us, that's for sure.
You know, and
it's not in the direction of more freedom and better living. It's really quite the opposite.
There was a famous book. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was about extremism. I'm
mm-hmm.
trying to remember who wrote it. And it was a theory that they could take anybody who was extremist from, and it was dealing with how what Hitler figured out. He actually took neo-communists and turned them into neo-fascist Nazis.
Mm.
And it was his theory that you can take that extremist mentality of a person who's so beholden like that and
mm-hmm.
switch them one way or to the other.
Well, that's not surprising.
And it just seems like you could, you know, look at, we had like the Soviets with their communist countries and people talked about how bad they were, and here we have the same situation in other countries, but we're also having our own countries becoming its own Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's really funny how everything seems to turn into its own opposite sooner or later, and it just happens, and then you all of a sudden you realize, gee, this used to be a free country, now it's a police state.
And Lance, in fact, I have something, if you don't mind, I can read. I love to read from my book. If people, it's basically, if anybody asks, like if somebody asks me, hey, if you, there's one thing in your book you could say, what would it be that really lay out what your basic theme in your book?
Yeah.
And it's basically what we're talking about. And if
it's
okay with you, I could read
it real
quickly.
Of course.
Okay, well, this is a part where basically Jerry Fletcher is, and it's toward the end, and I can tell you what it is, but it's, he's giving a speech out.
Okay.
And anyway, he says, thank you. I momentarily paused, then replied, that this moment reminds me of a great passage from the Tao Te Ching. It is said that a great nation is like a great man. When he makes a mistake, he realizes it. Having realized it, he admits it. Having admitted, he corrects it. He considers those that point out his faults as his most benevolent teacher. He thinks of his enemy as a shadow that he himself casts. If a nation is centered, it nourishes its own people and doesn't meddle in the affairs of others.
Mm.
It will be a light to all other nations in the world. Therefore, I say let go of the law and the people become serene, honest.
Mm-hmm.
Let go of economics and people become prosperous. Let go of religion and people become serene. Let go of all the desire for the common good, and the good becomes common as grass. And that's basically the bottom line. But we're talking about what I try to present within my book,
mm-hmm.
but utilizing, you know, obviously the connection with aliens.
Mm-hmm. I like that. That's
you fun. Know, and I have, like, people ask me, I just set up several layers within my book. And I know you had brought up, on one of your emails, you said, how come you use so much profanity?
Well, I was going to mention it because, you know, I know that people will probably check your book out, and some people will buy it, and I just want to warn people that there is a lot of profanity in it, so you might have trouble. You just have to kind of, you know, go through that part if that's something that you don't like. But why did you use so much?
Okay. It's like somebody, I had somebody interviewed me a while back, and they asked me why I use so much profanity, and I says, well, you know, and me as a reader, I says, do you ever read any of, like, Breakfast of the Champions? There's a lot of profanity in there.
Yeah.
You read Mario Puzo's Godfather, a lot of profanity in there.
True.
And if you leave, I mean, so it's not, so it's trying to bring what is trying to be realistic of the character. And the character you'll see, he was, like I said, he is very crude.
Yeah.
Very obnoxious.
Yeah.
Feels very immature.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even there, and I'm paraphrasing because I can't. I know we're on air, so I can't use the exact words that were in my book. But there's one part of the girl who, you know, they get very romantic. He calls him, he's like a Buddha man, but he's also like a, you know, pervert or whatever you want to call it. But it's to show that someone who can be so crude,
mm-hmm.
you can't judge who is, that he might be some very great, you know, spiritual person.
Yeah.
And somebody who can be the opposite, you think he's so ordained, so quiet,
yeah,
he could be,
yeah.
you know, like a priest or another Foley, you know, molesting a little kid or something.
Yep, yep.
So you cannot judge on the person's demeanor from the outside. It's on his inside that's what counts.
Well, yes, and you know, I'm glad you mentioned that because that really is a good point. You know, and that does make more sense. You know, when I'm, you know, maybe I didn't have my, you know, my English glasses on. You know, and I wasn't picking up on that, but that really does fit in when you mention it like that. That, you know, that the everyday man has the capacity to rise up to great heights, that we have this within us, and those who are at the heights could have the capacity to be at the depths.
Exactly, and you can't really judge that. You know, it can be a person you would see who. See, my thing is, I feel that somebody who can be almost have selective Tourette's in them, as I'd call it, and say all kinds of stuff,
yeah.
and then within their own heart,
yeah.
they are so loving toward God and toward humanity and go out of their way, but you can see the most obnoxious people, and, you know, that would be like, you know, it'd be like almost like I mean, it'd be like, I don't know if you remember with Eddie Murphy, The Golden Child.
Oh, yeah, I love that one.
Well, you remember the little spiritual guy?
Yeah.
And how obnoxious, and he was saying all the crudest things you can think of.
Yeah.
And he was picking his nose, picking his butt, and yet he was a spirit guy.
Well, that's true.
And that's what I was trying to show. I was trying to show.
Okay, well, then
that
makes a hell, I mean, I can say hell on air. It makes a hell of a lot of sense.
But that's what I was trying to basically employ. And, you know, and like I said, I was trying, you know, I did write a lot of screenplays, so I'm really pretty, really in depth with writing colloquial, you know, speech within, you'll see it with my book. That's what goes really quick, very easy. You're like, watch, you're in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to be realistic, and I felt if I, and originally, I had it originally put in, all just like how you see it, and I was thinking about pulling out a lot of it because some people had questioned the profanity.
Uh-huh.
And my editor in New York, he said, you know, you got to keep that in there because that keeps it realistic.
Yeah.
And well, if I pulled it out, it wouldn't be, you would lose the dimension of that character of what he really is. And I know, I took the chance, like most artists, you'll just,
yeah,
you got to, you know, take it, you know, some people get all offended by it, and, you know, I tell people it's rated R, it's not PG.
Yeah, exactly, and it's just part of the character, like you said, and characters do, you know, swear, and they can be salt of the earth and achieve great spiritual heights, too, of course. And he does at the end. I don't want to give it away, but, I mean, he really rises to the occasion, and you know, there's some surprise twists and turns in it, so I won't spoil those for people. But I really, that was the fun part, you know, after I got through some of the expletives and, you know, got behind the character, the ideas behind them were really a lot of fun. Do you think, after writing this, I mean, now that you see that what you saw in 2000 is actually coming true, I mean, really fast, and this is 2006, do you see doing another one that maybe projects even a little bit more towards 2010 or 12?
Actually, I have a sequel to this book, but it really doesn't do that. When I wrote this, like I said, actually, like you said, in fact, in one part of my book, I mentioned 9/11. I didn't say 9/11, but there's a part of it in there.
Mm-hmm.
I said there's an element where I said, well, the Twin Towers are falling faster. They're falling faster than the Twin Towers in New York. And then I knew there was going to be an Iraqi war, you know, the war in Iraq. And, you know, the situation that's happening right now with the cultural war, I knew that was going to, you know, start blossoming.
Mm-hmm.
But, I haven't really thought of, I have an idea to write down the line a futuristical book that would be like, you know, 20 years ahead. And I was thinking about doing something like that. But right now I have, on this book, there's already a sequel set up that's to be released in 2008.
Okay.
And he's called, it's the same main character, and he's called the Heretic. Well, the book's called The Heretic.
Uh-huh.
And he just has some very strange dreams in the very beginning, you see. And then he meets an old friend, and I'm not going to tell you where he is at that stage, because it's part of within the other book as well.
Okay.
But he gets regressed, and then when he gets regressed, he finds his, he has past lives, and he finds himself back in the time of Alexander the Great, and that book is like a lot of comedy, but it's like a satire, but it's in a fun book. But it goes into detailed wars, and this guy's actually like a hero, if you can imagine, a Jet Li back then. This is him, and he's the guy who really does everything, not Alexander. He's like rides along with him and tails him, I left one part out. There is a E.T. connection, because how he became a great soldier, one of the events, he finds a sword that looks like a samurai sword out in the middle of his field.
Wow.
As a kid, and he learned to train with it, but the sword cuts right through metal.
One of those.
Right, and it's like a action book, and then I took off in that book is that he is a Alexander was so into Homer and thinking he felt that this character, and in that book and back in time he's called Aias. He is actually the Ares incarnate. He thinks he's a god. And so that book took me about a year and a half to do research, year and a half to research, and only took me about a month to write.
Wow.
And it's like that the book, When the Angels Have Risen, is only 140 pages. That one's about 400 pages.
Whoa.
Because it goes really very, very in-depth to each little battle event, and it starts during the time even when Alexander was a kid, as learning, and I mean, it goes all the way up until his death, and it goes past his death.
Well, sounds like you did some research on that one.
Yeah. So it's different, you know, but it's part of my sequel, and I do have a prequel that I'm going to also do too. That's halfway done.
You know, it's funny that you mention about past lives, because there are a lot of people today that are coming out with books about having regressed their patients, and they not only have past lives, but they have future lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of them are on ships, and, I mean, anything you can imagine seems to be coming out of the woodwork right now. And, of course, there are so many people that believe that the advanced beings are here and have been for a long time. So, you know, that idea in your book is really very relevant today.
Well, I believe in reincarnation. I believe that we all come into this plane, you know, and we and we're not all our soul. I do not believe that our souls are Earth originate. I believe that our souls
that.
Are from different realms.
Yep.
And I believe they're today, and I feel still believe. I think there are what we would call alien and what I call star souls within the book, and who are not from this planet originally. And they can be your scientists, your psychics, your doctors, your philosophers,
mm-hmm.
or prophets,
quantum physicists,
physicists, and you know, on and on. On one side, on the light side, and on the dark side, they could be still your Hitlers, your Idi Amins, or you know, they can be the most ruthless people on the dark side as well, because I believe there's two sides. There's a light side and a dark side.
Yeah.
And I feel there's a lot of people who are originally from this light, and they're still, like, want to play the drone mentality. And I think a lot of it has to do because they're so connected here. And a lot of people, I also point within the book, that have come who are, I believe, star souls may feel alien. And they may be people who are induced because they feel so alien and they have to medicate, take drugs, or do something bad. And they're really because they don't know what to do with themselves.
Yes, absolutely.
They haven't connected with their real path is. And that's what I also try to present within my book.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like I said, I have different levels within my book. I try to provide, obviously, the political side, there's a spiritual side, there's a romance side, and, you know, a little humor
mm-hmm.
splashed all through. And, of course, like, you know, a little F here and a little F there in the beginning that might hit a little here and there, but
yeah.
A little F here and there, we wouldn't be around now, would we?
That's true. You know, it's funny because you mentioned about being from other places, and I meet a lot of people online that are starseed or indigo or walk-ins or crystals. And, one of my guests, one of my first guests, Jean-Claude Coven, talked about the Wanderers and that there are 60 million that incarnated, on the planet that are alive now that agreed to come here to wake the others up. And they came in under the veil of forgetfulness and have fallen asleep, so they need to be awakened. So
I think that's already happening.
Do you think so?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's beginning to build, but I just
I think that's why we're at a
crucial
period, and I think that's why if I don't like using the word like the end of all days, but I think
right.
it's the beginning of all days. I think we're coming to a head where, and I think that's why we have this extremism in organized religions pulling so fast, trying to grasp the last straw, because people are waking up and go, wait a second.
Yeah.
You know, their higher selves, people's self-worthiness is slowly evolving, and I think that it's on a spiritual vibration is changing. And that's where, you know, somebody asked me, why in my book I called When the Angels Have Risen, it definitely deals with angels, as angels connected with as spirit guides to the aliens, but there is a comment will be different, as he says, there's a quote, and I'm quoting from my book, but because Jerry Fletcher asked him, when is this going to happen? He says, when the angels have risen.
Wow.
And that's the whole point.
Wow. Why don't you, before we get too far into the hour, tell people where your website is and where they can find your book?
Okay, my book, you can go to my website at www.andrew.com. On there, of course, you'll have a kick. You'll see spaceship land, and and you'll have, out pops out of the spaceship, Buddha, Jesus, Moses, and Muhammad, and they'll have a little wrap about my book. There are links from there to go take you straight into, you can read about my book and also about myself. It'll take you also links straight to Barnes Noble, Amazon.com, also directly to my publisher. It's available on most online services like Buy.com and Pals, and I mean, it's all over. You can even Frugal my book, and you'll find it.
Yeah.
It's also available, if you do not have it at any of your local bookstores, they can always order it. You can just go, hey, Andrew Fetter, When the Angels Have Risen, pop on a computer, and, you know, they'll send it to you, you know. So it's definitely, it's distributed all worldwide. I mean, my book is in Europe. It's been pretty big over in the UK, in France.
So. Yeah.
It's banned. You won't get it if you're in China now. It's banned, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
They're too busy working in the slave factory at Walmart.
Yeah, really.
You know, what was I going to ask you? Oh, yeah. So it does seem like we're reaching a critical juncture, and you're kind of pointing to that. And it does seem that things need to get worse before they get better, and that the planet is kind of purging all these millions of years of our inhabitation here, and stuff is coming up to be released.
I mean, I really definitely believe it. I think, you know, people have choices.
Yes.
And I believe God gives choices, even like, for example, here, I'll give you a quick example. Bush, as bad as his situation was, I believe God in the universe goes, okay, you know what? We had a bad thing. We had 9/11. The people were united. People were actually caring about each other. Mm-hmm. The world was behind, looked up to the U.S. So I believe that God in the universe handed, here's your chance, Bush. You know, you had your chance to, you know, we question you how you became president, but he had the opportunity to be probably one of the greatest presidents since FDR and Kennedy in this country. But what did he do? He took that opportunity and selfishly manipulated it for his own gain, for his own power, and not just him, along with the Republicans, to establish control using the fear card.
Yep.
And it made us alienated around the world, and so the world looking up to as a beacon light, and that's what I mentioned in my book, you know, as a great nation, be a beacon within light, it's fabricated. Now we're coming to the head where people are waking up, and they're going, wait a second.
Yeah.
You know, they find out that, you know, how the Republicans are, and not saying the Democrats are any better, but, you know, you don't have as much narcissistical, ambitious control to manipulate things to, I think there's a change. I think, like, I look at the what's his name? I believe his name is Obama, you know, the senator from Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And I believe, like, here's an example of probably a great leader down the road.
Uh-huh.
You know, I see people rising up and changing, and people, you know, and my last thing, I hope that, because we're on the air, I hope everybody votes. Because if you don't vote, you don't matter.
Well, that's a good point, and I thank you for reminding us about that. In fact, time for local registration is running out, too, so, you know, that's something that we all should consider. You know, and we do count, you know. I think that's important for people to remember that we're not victims, that it just takes one person to change the world. And that we can change it, and we don't have to tolerate something that's not acceptable any longer from an old paradigm. And but it takes courage to stand up for your convictions. Have you noticed any flack from about your book from as far as the radical views and the rebelliousness of it? I mean, anything?
I originally when it was first released, it was released back in the summer.
Uh-huh.
And then I had started sending it out and putting on blogs and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And apparently some right-wing blog, actually from California, attacked my book. Without even reading the book, they took off what was on the website of my publisher and tried to, you know, attack me. They go, ha-ha, this is President Halliburton. Who's the vice president? Enron? You know, that was their comment without even knowing, but nobody's really. I've even had clerics. I mean, I've had ministers buy my book, and after reading and talking to them, they realize, hey, you know, I'm telling what it is. I had one of my coworkers. In fact, she even wrote up a thing for me. Well, not for me, but she wrote it up for Amazon, and she was really right wing, religious, behind the book. You know, a Bush. Advocate.
I read that.
And she,
favorable.
Yeah, and she wrote her thing after reading. Says she liked it so much. She goes, I'm putting this thing out. She was going, oh God, I was this Andy. She was this Antichrist book. I said, no, read it. You'll see. This is definitely. And then she was very curious, and she read it with open mind, and she's, you know, realized what I was trying to say was no far from what in her heart. As a Christian, she was trying to get within her mind. I said, this is what Jesus was all about. Yeah. Not about having a little building, not having turning him to a deity and turning him to a son of God, but learning what he was trying to say.
Yep.
You know, instead of getting away from, you know, being a Romanizing God, Jesus, which is what I call it, because I don't think that's what he was looking at. That's why his last thing he said on the cross was really important. He says, "O Lord God, why hast thou forsaken me?" was to show that he is not a God, that don't pray to him.
Uh-huh.
Don't look at him as some deity. And actually, it was not even the best thing he said, because that's within biblical events, the person, the most righteous person, by the way, I believe, is Daniel. Because what Jesus did at that time was just why Moses did the same thing, kicking the rock. There's a story about that, of, you know, being all upset, and he did something in vain against toward God. And so I felt that diminished it, and that he was trying to show his human side, that he really was just human, but he was trying to spread a message. And I think part of a lot of his message was break down the hierarchy of organized religion, and that your religion is within your heart.
Yeah.
And he was also, people don't realize, he was, if he was today living, he'd be considered a very socialist, or very, I wouldn't say communist, but very socialistic in his ideas for economics.
Yes. Well,
I mean, he really wanted to spread the wealth, because, I mean, he's made numerous sermons within there, I mean, from the seed, mustard seed, and et cetera, about dividing the wealth. So that's, people lose the message. I mean, I'm telling people who are Christians, look at the real, what the real important thing is. And even Jews, they, instead of looking at what the laws of putting tefillin on and all that, these are mechanics. And we say there's a thing we say instead in Deuteronomy, and you say it, supposed to say it three times. The most important thing you say in Judaism, you're supposed to say even before you die, is, "Hear, Israel, Lord our God, the Lord is one." But right below it is, there's a prayer that says, excuse me, it says, basically, in a nutshell, is, "Lord, O God, I love you with all my heart, with all my soul, with all my might." That is the most important thing, to love with all your heart and love
not,
everything around you.
And not just for, you know, the deity or the source, but for everything that is.
Right.
And that means our fellow man, and that means our supposed enemies, it means, and love for ourselves, and
mm-hmm.
it means treating everybody with that same love and respect, because there are no enemies. That's just a false creation that's designed to control.
Right.
So the real message of love and forgiveness and unity has gotten, you know, distorted, and I think your book is a good attempt at you know, pointing this out and getting people to think and prodding them and poking them, and you know, and it was a fun read, and I think people will enjoy it, and maybe it will inspire people to write their own books.
Yeah, I mean, I have people meet me at book signing events, and young kids, after reading it, I shouldn't say young kids, but they do, a lot of like high school and college kids buying my book.
Oh,
like,
I can see where it would take off.
Yeah, and
they need something to relate to, because everything is kind of effed up.
Yeah, and they sort of like, I've even had people I know who, they bought my book, and then they, you know, I knew them indirectly, and then they call me up and they say, "You know what? I never read a book at all. I'm basically functional literate, but I read your book." You know,
that's,
you know,
really cool.
You know that,
I really like that.
Yeah.
You know, and now that I've talked to you about it, I think that, you know, maybe those expletives serve a real good purpose. You know, we don't always know why we're doing what we're doing, or, you know, why we write or say what we do, but sometimes it seems to have the best and most profound effect on people, and it's almost as if God is working through us. Well, Andrew, guess what? We're almost out of time.
God, we need another hour.
Well, you know, this has been a wonderful chat. You have been a great guest.
Oh, appreciate it.
And I've had a lot of fun talking to you, and I hope that people, you know, check out his book, and, you know, I have to warn you about the expletives, but you've been warned, so, you know, but it's a fun book, and it has some great ideas in it, and Andrew, thank you so much for being with us.
And Lance, thank you for having me on your show, and God bless all of you.
Oh, and God bless you, too. Good night, everybody.